You have reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your Yuletide question after the tone.
Hello, my name is Jeff from Maine, and I was just curious, what exactly is a nog, and is there any other kind besides egg? Thank you.
Every little seasonal beverage question, we'll investigate. We have food celeb Kenji Lopez-Alt here to help with this eggnog inquiry.
I am a food writer.
He's author of The Food Lab, a 900-page cooking Bible, and he has done a longitudinal study on eggnog aging.
I think it sort of peaks in flavor within the first few months or so, and then it kind of tapers off. And then between a year and 2 years, there's not really that much of a difference.
So are you a big eggnog fan?
I am, yeah. Yeah, I definitely am.
Like year-round? Like 365 days a year?
No.
Eggnog or...
No, nog is really a Christmas time thing for me, and I am a fan of nog. It's one of those drinks that you drink way more alcohol and more calories than you realize, and it works fast, but it's delicious.
Yeah, I wouldn't say but, and.
And it's delicious.
Okay, Kenji, we're here because of listener Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Jeff wants to know, what is a nog?
What is a nog? So a modern eggnog is a custard drink. So it's custard and alcohol. So it's cold, uncooked custard with booze in it.
Delish. So where did the drink come from? Was there like a proto nog?
So there were old drinks called possets, which were like milk that were mixed with wine or milk mixed with ale.
Possets?
And those I think were like, yeah, they're called possets, P-O-S-S-E-T. And I think those were around since like maybe Elizabethan England. Like they're pretty old.
How did eggnog get its name?
This is one of those terms where the etymology is not actually really that well known. One of the theories is that it came from a combination of egg and grog, you know, grog being the old term for booze, for hooch. So when you combine that with egg, I think it was called egg and grog, and then people shortened that to eggnog. That's one of the stories. I think that one is sort of like the, you know, barbecue comes from the French for barbecue, which is like completely apocryphal and probably inaccurate, but...
But it's cute.
It is cute. It is cute, yeah.
What's the more plausible explanation for the name eggnog?
So it's a nog. It's an old English drink. And nog itself, I think, referred to the name of the cup that these sort of custard-based drinks were served in.
So the nog is the cup?
That's what I think.
What would be served in the nog cup? Back in the day.
They didn't used to always be custard-based. Some of them, I think, were just sort of like really strong ales that were then kind of poked with a red-hot poker to heat them up.
What?
I think that, yeah, and like the idea was that you would take the poker and dip it into the drink, and it would very quickly sort of vaporize it and make it turn really nice and foamy.
So flashy.
Yeah.
So the other thing Jeff wanted to know today, is egg the only nog?
I think it's the only thing we call nog. I mean, there's certainly a lot of eggnog-like drinks around the world.
I'll just be honest. I'm not a huge fan of eggnog.
That's recipe developer and food writer Mercedes Rivera. She created the Puerto Rican food blog, thenoshery.com. And Mercedes says, leave that uncooked egg beverage behind.
It's just like so custardy and eggy. It's just a lot.
But there are alternatives if you are feeling nogged out. Mercedes has the scoop on the holiday beverage of choice from the island where she grew up.
In Puerto Rico, the quintessential Christmas drink is coquito, which translates literally as little coconut. And I think the differences between eggnog and coquito is that even though coquito is rich and it's sweet, because of that coconut flavor, I find it to be a little bit more refreshing.
You had me a drink. How do I make it?
Everybody can make it. It's sweetened condensed milk, a can of evaporated milk, a can of coconut cream, which is like a Coco Lopez or something like that, a little bit of nutmeg, some vanilla, cinnamon, and then like the rum, a lot of rum.
Always rum.
Yes. And if you want to be really hardcore, it's a Don Q or Don Q rum, because they are the original rum family of Puerto Rico.
When do you drink coquito?
I would say it's like a holiday aperitif. Our Christmas season is much longer than like the Christmas season in the United States. So the kickoff is Thanksgiving, and then it goes to mid-January.
Poquito season is like 2.5 months long.
Pretty much. I mean, if there's anything about the Puerto Rican culture, it's like we know how to celebrate. Like, we know how to party. Like, it's kind of funny because if you were to listen to Puerto Rican Christmas music or like tropical, you know, Spanish Caribbean Christmas music compared to like American Christmas music, like here in the States, everything is like Silent Night, and, you know, just very like Charles Dickens Christmas Carol kind of setup. And in Puerto Rico, the theme of most Christmas songs is like drinking and food. Like, there is a song, you hear it always during the holidays, and the chorus of the song literally says, to eat pork, to eat a pot of rice, to eat some pasteles, which is like our kind of version of tamales, and then to drink rum. And that's like the chorus. Like, straight to the Christmas party.
I think I found the song, but I want to double check.
Okay.
All right.
You are on point.
Thanks, Mercedes. Happy holidays.
You too.
We'll have Mercedes' Coquito recipe and Kenji's eggnog recipe on our Instagram and Twitter. Stay tuned. After the break, we're going to another party, a party happening above your head. Since it's the holiday season, we have a little gift for you. A really cool person who I think you'll want to meet. A couple years ago, I had the pleasure of hearing a talk by this biologist who discovered a whole other world right here on Earth. And I thought you would enjoy hearing from her, too. Her name is Meg Lauman, and she's one of the first scientists to go into the canopy, the tops of trees, to see what lives there. Imagine Meg 200 feet up, swaying in the treetops, discovering a world filled with little things.
There are two places on Earth where we think most things live. One is the coral reef, and the other is the tropical rainforest canopy. So based on the numbers of discoveries coming in, it's now pretty well assumed that perhaps 50% of land-based diversity comes from rainforests, and the majority of that would be in the canopy.
Half of life on land comes from the rainforest, and most of it lives in the treetops.
Yes. And truly, we don't know exactly, but most of us feel that we've probably only discovered about 10% of what's in the canopy. When you think of how few trees have been climbed, we can be sure that we have missed so many things.
Are there organisms that live their whole lives in the canopy that never come down to solid ground?
Absolutely. Absolutely and totally. And that's really part of the magic of why there are allegedly so many species we've never discovered, because most of them don't come to the ground.
How did you get into the tops of trees?
By mistake. I first climbed a tree because my advisor in graduate school said I should, and I was not one of those stars in gym class or anything in school. And he just said, you have to do that. I said, couldn't I train a monkey? Couldn't I use binoculars? But I ended up sewing my harness and making a slingshot out of a piece of metal in the school welding shop and borrowing a rope from a caver, and bingo, up I went.
So the slingshot gets the rope over the branch so you can hoist yourself up?
Absolutely. And so I was going up and down just the opposite way from a caver who would go down and then up.
Why did you have to hand make your own harness and slingshot?
Well, there was no L.L. Bean or REI or any kind of outing, you know, recreational groups when I first started doing this in the late 1970s. So there was no source to get a harness. And so when I did realize that I had to figure out how to get up this darn tree, I felt pretty intimidated. The trees in Australia are relatively tall. The canopy goes upwards to about 200 feet. So I needed a rope twice that size.
Were you scared the first time? Or what was it like?
I was scared out of my wits.
You were?
I was more curious than scared. I was determined. I had this, what I thought was a very easy question for my PhD research, which was to see how long a leaf lives on a tree. And I just thought,
oh, I love that question.
Yeah. And, you know, I came from the temperate zone. So I knew 6 months was the, you know, maximum for a leaf in Vermont or upstate New York. And I just thought, oh, it will probably be 2 years. I don't know why I thought that, but it just seemed that was plenty long for a tropical leaf to live. And lo and behold, some leaves lived over 20 years.
A 20-year-old leaf.
Oh, here's another cool thing. Those old leaves usually are covered with dust. Sometimes they're covered with moss and lichen. So from the energy point of view of the tree, they probably aren't photosynthesizing a lot. They're probably almost like grandparents, but yet the tree is keeping them there for some little bit of value to those very senior citizens.
Meg, grandparents might take issue with that comparison.
Well, I think it's a respect. I think it's wonderful. I'm so happy that there's a community that's appreciating and saving their grandparents instead of shuttling them off to somewhere else.
So when you're up in the canopy, what is it like?
Well, it's a little bit windy, so your tree is going to be swaying a little bit, and you got to kind of get used to that just the same way you would if you were a sailor. And you have to keep your eye on the weather, because the one thing about tree climbing, it is very, it's a fair weather sport. If it's lightning and thundering or pouring with rain, you have to get out. So you hear things, you smell things, you see things. All your five senses are on overdrive, basically.
What does it sound like?
Well, it's a symphony to me. I love bird songs and animal songs. So it's amazing. And you can read the sounds. Some of my colleagues that I taught to climb in India can hear sounds, and they know, for example, when maybe there's danger, maybe there's an eagle flying overhead because all the animals stop singing. And, you know, you can interpret all the different things that are going on around you once you learn the voices of the canopy.
Is there a particular smell?
It's gorgeous. I love the smell. It's very earthy. There's a lot of soil in the canopy, believe it or not, in
what?
The tree crotches, under the bromeliads. But the smell up there is a lot more, how can I say, growth. There's that green leaf smell, and there's that smell of rain that's coming down the bark. And then there are all those overlays of insect smells because, you know, stink bugs have a smell if you squish one by mistake, and bits and pieces of, you know, things that are floating in pools in the centers of bromeliads that are a little bit like stagnant water smell. It's just, oh, really a smorgasbord of those five senses at work.
Do you get a rush when you go up there?
Oh, gosh, yes, I do. Oh, my gosh. I'm just starting a project in Bhutan. I'm going there in a month, and I can't wait.
Do you have a favorite canopy creature?
I do. Favorite canopy creature. I love the giant stinging tree because it's full of toxic hairs that sting you on the leaf surfaces and the stem surfaces. But what I love most is that the giant stinging tree beetle lives in the giant stinging tree. And guess what? It has the ability to digest the toxins and eat the giant stinging tree. So I think that's very cool.
Is there something about the canopy that makes it a good place to live?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. When you think about it, there's something like 1% of light on the forest floor compared to the canopy. So the canopy is receiving amazing amounts of solar energy, and that is the center of all of the food chains. So it makes sense for so many things to be up where the leaves are growing the most actively, where the flowers are flowering, and so the pollinators are hanging out, and the fruit eaters are hanging out, and the things that eat the pollinators are hanging out, and the things that eat the fruit eaters are hanging out.
It's weird to think that there's just like a party going on above my head.
I know. Wow. And that's back to my first climb. When I first climbed, a coachwood tree was the common name for this tree that I selected as my first species because it has a very good solid timber and I felt comfortable picking a branch to put my rope over. But when I got into that sun area, it was like a party going on. I call it the salad bar in the sky. That's my own little name because most things are herbivores. Of course, they're eating the foliage and it's like having 50 species of lettuce up there.
Meg, before you rigged up your harness and made your slingshot in the 1970s, what research had been done on the canopy? What did scientists know?
Nobody was doing this research, so that was the crazy thing. For almost 200 years, when you think about it, foresters were studying from the ground, so we had this amazing tunnel vision about trees. If something fell out of the tree, they might have found it, and it wasn't until we did get into the canopy that, lo and behold, we found so many things lived up there, but it was all brand new. And, you know, we had scuba in the 1950s, and that allowed us to really explore coral reefs. We actually went to the moon in the 1960s, which is pretty cool. And then it wasn't until the 1980s that we went into the trees in our own backyard. So we had totally overlooked this, what I call the eighth continent, a whole world above our heads.
Why do you think we had overlooked it?
I think we took it for granted. A tree is a tree is a tree. We saw the trunk, we cut it down, and then we thought we saw the top, but we forgot that almost everything flies away when you cut it down or dies or disappears. So we had maybe a very complacent sense about what a forest is all about, and a forest was usually about walking on a trail at the bottom of it, but almost never about a trail at the top of it.
If you have a burning question you cannot find the answer to, please give us a ring, 833-RING-ELT, 833-RING-ELT. We're on break for the next few weeks, but we'll be back in January. So see you in 2019, and Happy New Year.
Every Little Thing is produced by Phoebe Flanagan, Aaron Reese, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Ian Chillog and Caitlin Kenny are our consulting editors. Scored by Dara Hirsch and Dan Brunel. Mixing by Dara Hirsch. Goodbye.